I recently had the pleasure, and it really was a pleasure, of talking with Chef Etienne about her recent book, Visionary Journeys, Travel Writings from Early Medieval and 19th Century China. And that came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2011. Now, Etienne's book was interesting for me in so many ways. It's a study in comparative literary history, really in its most exciting form, and with a comparison that makes total sense and informs both sides of the story. Both the early medieval and the 19th century China story really wouldn't be the same without the other comparative case. And so it's quite a thoughtfully conceived comparison in that way. There's so many thoughtful contributions that the book makes, not just to the study of travel writing and literature, of course. This should be required reading for anyone who's interested in the history of travel literature and writing, especially as it relates to China, but also to the history of seeing and observation and art history as well. It really helped me understand how to put Buddhism into greater dialogue with the histories of travel and of literature related to it. And it's just, in many ways, a model of transdisciplinary humanistic scholarship. I hope you enjoy the book and enjoy listening in on our recent conversation about it. Hello, Xiaofei.
Hi, Carla.
We're here today at the New Book Network to talk with Xiaofei Tian about her wonderful recent book, Visionary Journeys, Travel Writings from Early Medieval and 19th Century China. And that just came out in 2011 with Harvard University Press, and it's a Harvard University Asia Center book. Thank you so much for making time to talk with us about your book today, Xiaofei.
Oh, thank you, Carla. It's my pleasure.
Oh, it was for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, this is a really, really wonderful work. And it was especially a wonderful surprise because for those of us who aren't who are in Chinese history or history of science, it's not always that we will kind of pick up a book on Chinese poetry or Chinese literature and feel like it's completely relevant to what we're doing, right? I mean, there tend to be kind of disciplinary conventions that are different in the different fields we work in. But this book really transcends that in this beautiful way that makes it feel like what you're writing is extraordinarily relevant and speaks to historians, anyone who's interested in poetry, in China, in travel, in genre, or in really more broadly work that transcends genre and discipline. So thank you so much. It was just a wonderful experience to read this.
Well, thank you very much, Carla. You were very kind.
No, it was really a pleasure. Xiaofei, can you start us up or start us off a little bit by just saying a little bit about your background and maybe specifically what brought you to this topic in particular?
Okay. My background is, I'm interested in early medieval China, and I consider myself a scholar of literary studies and primarily engaged in research in early medieval China. But I have a very broad sort of interest. Since, you know, from a very early age, I've been interested in classical Chinese literature, but actually I got my PhD in comparative literature. And so I do have a sort of very broad interest in literature, world literature, Chinese and European literatures, but also in my own kind of writing and teaching, I not only teach specialized courses on early medieval China, but I also teach and write about late imperial period and even a course actually in modern China in the Cultural Revolution, to be specific.
Wow.
Actually, my students in that class are going to have a symposium this very afternoon. As you can see, I myself kind of really kind of have a very sort of a wide range of interests, largely in literature and cultural studies and cultural history.
Great. And what brought you to the topic of this book in particular, which really ranges, and this is one of the things that we'll certainly talk about, but it's a book that ranges from early medieval China through the 19th century and looks particularly at travel writing, kind of broadly construed and related issues. So what brought you to this in particular?
Okay. Well, first of all, I love travel. I love, you know, like physical travel, but I also kind of like the, you know, the mind travel and, you know, being in different places and really kind of opens a lot of new vistas. So I'm always very interested in travel itself. I'm interested in travel writing. But this book, specifically speaking about this book, I guess it's really hard to talk about, I guess, one point of origin. You know, it's like in physical travel, we start from one single place. But in writing a book, I feel like it's very much like going on a journey. It's kind of hard. It's funny because it's hard to talk about one single point of origin. I guess, you know, abstractly speaking, I guess I've just been noticing a lot of similarities between these two periods. The early medieval China, that is, you know, especially this kind of, from the first century through, 6th, 7th century, I would say, and also the 19th century, because the two periods when China really kind of undergoes huge cultural transformations, especially with the large amount of translation. I just noticed a lot of points of similarity between the two periods in the course of my reading and research and teaching. So that's the sort of a kind of, I would call abstractly speaking, this is kind of one of the things that started me, you know, to become interested in doing a kind of a comparative study or in these two periods. But more concretely speaking, I always think of a funny story I had once with one of my friends who's a Chinese friend who's from Sichuan, and so we were talking about food, we were talking about, of course, Sichuan food, and then I was casually saying that Sichuan food has not always been, you know, spicy la because the pepper was from the New World, and he got really, really upset with me. You know, and he was just saying, but of course the Sichuan food has always been hot and spicy. I said, well, not really, you know, because chili pepper is really from North America, you know, so it's really not all. But then I was thinking of all this, the story in the early medieval China in the 3rd century, actually, when the Cao Wei emperor was just writing a communication sort of, you know, with one of his ministers and saying that people from Shu, the modern day Sichuan, their food is kind of a sweet. They like honey in their food. And, you know, I just this kind of, all this is a sort of kind of interesting experience to me, because it kind of made me think of all the mobility of things, you know, food and, kind of going back and forth, and how, you know, what do we consider really kind of very Chinese today, you know, once upon a time was really a kind of a foreign product or something that had come from very far. And after a while, you know, people sort of have this kind of short cultural memory, and you tend to think, oh, this is, you know, this is Chinese, or this is, you know, has always been the case, but it hasn't always been the case. And so I just thought, you know, the kind of immense, you know, sort of mobility of things, dislocation is just, you know, to use food as a kind of, one example. I just find that so fascinating, that things have changed so much. And so, you know, and people forgot about the origin, the place of origin, and become integrated into your culture and what we consider as our own today. But, you know, we just forgot, you know, exactly what it was like, you know, even just 200 years ago, 300 years ago. But anyway, I just, this is, I don't know, I'm kind of a little bit of stream of consciousness. Okay. But that's one of the things that kind of got stuck in my mind when I was kind of started to think of writing a book and talking about the two periods in Chinese history and cultural history when really kind of things were undergoing tremendous change when people, foods, language, texts were in constant kind of mobility and dislocation, and how people deal with it and how they incorporate new things in what they have. And somehow these two periods just jump out as, you know, being so similar and yet so dissimilar in some profound ways. So in a way, that's kind of how I started thinking about writing this book.
That's great. Thank you so much. So I want to ask you a little bit about one of the ways that you talk about one of these periods. And I ask this in particular because I just got back from a really wonderful, very challenging conference on the medieval globe. One of the issues that was really hotly debated, or one of the issues that undergirded some of our conversations, was mm-hmm. the idea of talking about periods that were not European historical periodizations as medieval mm-hmm. or not medieval. And this is,
yes.
You certainly don't have to convince me because I'm completely on board. But I'd love to hear, because a choice of how to name periods is so fundamental
yes.
to our work, how did you come to the decision to talk about this period of roughly, as I think you said, the first through the sixth or the seventh centuries as early medieval?
Oh, this is the terminology, the periodization, that's just a kind of, this is actually quite a wonderful coincidence. I just read an article in PMLA and about the problem periodization, you know, it's written by a historian, I think this is such a kind of a thorny problem, and, you know, and I think the, you know, people who work in, you know, Chinese studies, I think we come up with period names like early medieval and middle period and early modern, but now it's kind of being disputed. I'm sure you know very well, especially the period you're working on.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I really don't have, you know, in many ways, I know that the medieval, especially the word medieval, I think, because it really kind of immediately makes people think of the medieval period in European history. And I think, and of course, in terms of real time, there's a big, you know, kind of disjunction and people would, you know, write, you know, talking about medieval history, you know, European medieval history would think of 12th century or 13th century, even, you know, or 10th century. But this is really, in the Chinese case, it's not, you know, people often would say it's from 1st century through 7th. So in many ways, I think I adopted this, you know, still the term medieval as a kind of a matter of convenience. It's very much like the you know, the Buddhist term, fang bian.
Right.
You know, I admit it's not, probably not, you know, entirely kind of satisfying, I think, but I just need a kind of a, I need a term to, you know, I can't just always say, you know, kind of first through 6th century or 7th century. But I think, you know, leaving aside the actual term itself, I admit is debatable, and I could have said early middle period, for example. But leaving aside the term itself, I do think there is a huge kind of change. That is, there's a justification for thinking of the first through seventh century as leaving early China or classical period or antiquity, Chinese antiquity behind. I think one of the, really profoundly kind of transformative things that made this a really kind of a grand period of it, you know, on its own is the, again, technology, the advent of technology. And in this case, I'm thinking of paper. Mm-hmm. You know, the invention of paper and also the availability of paper, you know, kind of paper became a much kind of a cheaper writing material, you know, replacing, you know, silk, which was very expensive, you know, which was still used in this period, but, you know, kind of only very, you know, kind of special occasions, I would say, but also it's so light and easy to carry around, you know, so it is rather than having, you know, wood or bamboo slips, you know, and which is very, very heavy and kind of hard to, I just think the invention and wider ability, you know, availability of paper as a cheaper writing material really changed a lot of things in this period. And also the spread of Buddhism. So these, you know, there are many other things, you know, social and kind of historical kind of conditions. But I think these two things at least are two huge factors in making this period, you know, kind of very different from the, you know, classical or antiquity, Chinese antiquity.
Thank you so much. And it's actually really interesting that you mentioned paper. I think recently, at least in the past months, I've read several books now by people writing about travel and the experience of travel in different, in very different geographical and temporal contexts that foreground the importance of paper to this process. I think there's material for a really interesting comparative cultural history of paper and travel there.
Yeah, absolutely. I especially think that, you know, for I cite, you know, at the opening of one of the book's chapters, I cited a bunch of letters by the famous calligrapher Wang Xizhi. And, you know, he was, you know, kind of writing to his friend who was on military campaign, again, to the Sichuan area and, you know, asking him all about the local sites and everything. And I just thought that this tremendous interest, you know, on the part of the audience back home and, you know, like learning what's going on, what did you see in your travel, you know, and for the traveler to kind of send a letter back, you know, to relate, you know, what he had, you know, witnessed with his own eyes. I just think this would become much, much more difficult, you know, if people didn't have paper, you know, which is such a light kind of material, you know, to use, you know, for this kind of back and forth. So I just think, you know, paper is especially kind of important, I guess, for traveler, you know, and kind of away from the convenience, you know, of home. And, you know, if they want to write a letter to home audience and you know, using paper is almost, you know, imperative, I think, you know, rather than kind of getting a whole bunch of really heavy wooden or bamboo slips.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned seeing and you also mentioned Buddhism a little bit earlier, and that really, I think, nicely brings us into the body of the book, which is, again, really wonderful. Now, you set, for listeners, again, who haven't yet seen the book is set up as would be perhaps not super surprising for a book that very explicitly compares early medieval and 19th century China. It's set up into two broad parts. So part one, visionary journeys, and part two, encountering the world, which treat these two periods in turn. Now, the first part, visionary journeys, really makes a point that will recur throughout the book, but is really focused on in a special way in these early chapters, and that's the importance of the really important changes in modes of seeing the world, both literally and as articulated in language, that are formulated and that emerge in the context of this mobility and dislocation and travel that you're, I think, very beautifully bringing us into in this book. And the first chapter in this, part one, looks specifically at the importance of visualization and seeing in mental image making, and specifically in its relation to Buddhism in early medieval China. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of Buddhism for visuality and seeing in early medieval China in this context?
Okay. All right.
I know it's a very broad question. So for the listeners, this is the whole chapter talks about this. So any part of this that you feel particularly interested in, feel free to speak to.
Sure. I think, well, maybe just a very broadly speaking, maybe two things about Buddhism that I think really, really, you know, sort of highlighted the importance of seeing both with physical eyes and with mind's, especially with mind's eye. One thing about Buddhism is that I think it's a, earlier you mentioned, you know, kind of it would be interesting to kind of think of different cultures and do a comparative, you know, sort of cultural studies. And when we were talking about paper, and actually this is after finished writing this book, I'm still kind of, you know, continue to think and work on some, you know, kind of the so-called leftover aspect, you know, when the book was finished. Sure. Was finished, but one thing I that came to my attention recently in my research is that so in early kind of a Christianity, I think it's very interesting that travel for Buddhist clergymen, you know, monks, and was not necessarily encouraged, and actually was sort of discouraged, you know, in the early days of Christianity. And I was thinking that was fascinating for me and to see, because I was thinking, you know, it's really exactly the kind of opposite for Buddhism in its, you know, sort of early years of, you know, kind of transmission spread in China. I was thinking of, you know, reading through this kind of biographies of eminent monks written by the 6th century monk Hui Jiao, and you know, and it just struck me how many biographies of those monks. Well, he basically talked, you know, there are biographies of monks, you know, from second or even, I suppose mostly from second through early years of 6th century, so several hundred monks, and in many biographies of these monks, he talks about the importance of physical and, you know, undertaking physical travel in order to spread Buddhist doctrine. And in one of the biographies, I remember it's very interesting because the monk actually didn't really want to leave his monastery, and his teacher, his master said, you know, if you are so attached to your monastery, how, you know, because he has been spending almost all his life there from, you know, since a young child, and so how could you, you know, possibly propagate the teaching of the Buddha to the rest of the world? And so, you know, I think it's really interesting that regards Buddhism, physical travel is very much kind of encouraged, and indeed almost like absolute must. It's really, you know, for the sake of propagating Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist teachings. And I think there was a lot of, you know, so in one way, I think Buddhism, you know, was very huge phenomenon in this period, in this early medieval period in Chinese history. And I was just thinking that, you know, the traveling, the circulation, and the, you know, going around of Buddhist clergy, monks, and also actually nuns, Buddhist nuns as well, you know, I think that's also, you know, you can think of travel and the gender, and that was also a very good opportunity for women to travel without the accompanying of their fathers or husbands or children, you know, basically they could also travel, you know, through, you know, the, you know, what we can, you know, the basically within the boundaries of, you know, the China, even though at the time is politically divided, but give them a very good reason to travel around. So I think travel and going around, this physical mobility is certainly very much has to do with kind of Buddhism, and also the teaching and, you know, of Buddhism and the spreading of Buddhist Dharma, you know, and all that. And the second thing I was thinking of that I was saying, you know, that's really kind of coming out, you know, in the about Buddhism and seeing. So it's not just going around and seeing the world, you know, and, you know, in kind of as a part of your physical travel and propagating a Buddhist Dharma. But also another thing is important thing for Buddhists, and this is not confined to Buddhist clergy, but also this is something that would be practiced by Buddhist laymen, laywomen as well, that is mind travel, that is meditation, especially the meditative visualization, or visualizing meditation. meditation either way, is this kind of a guanxiang process, which was considered extremely important method of reaching, or being, reborn in the Buddhist paradise, in the Pure Land. And the Pure Land sect was very popular, in this period, especially from, I suppose, from 4th century onward, because of the influence of this very eminent monk Hui Yuan in South China. He resided in Lushan, but he had a very wide-ranging kind of influence, and he was a great believer of this Pure Land Buddhism. Both for these fervent believers of pure Western Pure Land, that is Amitabha Buddha's Pure Land, and also for even just, people who not necessarily are meditating about the Pure Land or Amitabha Buddha's, paradise, I think, meditative visualization was a very important thing, for a way of practice for both Buddhist clergy and Buddhist lay people, lay believers in Buddhism as well. And so this is basically a kind of seeing the world in your, with mind's eye, and it's kind of a very tremendous emphasis on visualizing and seeing in your mind. So I think, this is another, I think, kind of a way for Buddhism to exert, a tremendous influence on the Chinese, people at the time. And I, of course, there are other things about, Buddhism was already even at this time was referred to as the Xiangjiao, the teaching of, the doctrine of images. And there were a lot of, actual visual images to aid people in the process of meditative visualization, and also aiding the Buddhist monks and nuns to preach. That is, they use, kind of looking at the mural paintings, And so especially we have a lot of records from South China in the Southern Dynasties. I think famous painters would, paint the mural paintings in Buddhist temples and monasteries. And all these, I think, is it was quite a spectacle. I think when they were completing their there are a lot of stories about that, and some kind of a legendary kind of painters how sort of supernatural feats sort of in the legend about this kind of painters doing their murals, and people would come to see when the murals are being completed, and then once they kind of added the eye of the dragon would fly away, become alive and all that. But I just think this is kind of, of course this is, kind of all the supernatural thing related to wonderful painting, but also it shows that, the kind of, the sort of spectacle, I think, the audience, they all come to see the mural paintings, in the Buddhist temples and the monasteries, and also the making of Buddhist statues. All these are part of a visual culture, and I think, conceptually speaking, and also in terms of material culture, there's just a lot of emphasis on visualization and seeing things both with physical eyes and especially importantly with your mind's eye, to be able to do image making your mind. And all this kind of become really important part of the discourse of the day.
That's great. And one of the things that's, I hope for listeners, becoming clear, even in the way you're speaking about this, is that this book as a whole really emphasizes the importance of, or at least for the reader, the importance of juxtaposition is really clear. And juxtaposition in the service of really sort of, as we briefly mentioned before, breaking down the boundaries that could traditionally carve up scholarship. In this chapter, we've heard a little bit now that you've very generously spoken with us about paintings and Buddhist scriptures, but this chapter also really wonderfully weaves together these sources with Taoist writings and commentaries and Fu, rhapsodies to tell this larger story about the importance of both mental and physical travel in the larger culture of seeing, which actually works really, really nicely. Now, the second chapter after this kind of extends this story in the story of visuality and travel in this period by talking about a different but related set of materials, namely military campaign records, on travel, focusing also on Faxian's Buddhist travelogue and also a comparative case of Egeria. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, I love that.
Egeria's account.
You use
this really wonderful juxtaposition to argue for the importance of the emergence in this period of a set of what you call rhetorical schemata of seeing the world, and that's in particular a historical mode of seeing. So this was particularly interesting to me as a historian, and also the importance of the heaven-hell paradigm. And both of these go on to become important throughout the book. Can you talk for a little bit, or as much as you want to, about the importance of kind of history and a historical mode of seeing to travel literature in this period? In particular, this comes up in the discussion of Xie Lingyun and his travel fu, which is really wonderfully translated in one of the appendices. So can you talk about that or any aspect of that you're interested in for us?
Oh, yes, sure. Yeah. That's what I refer to as historical mode of seeing is basically a kind of mode of seeing the world as almost like, you know, sites of history or historical sites. And that actually had been in the Chinese literary tradition, you know, part of the native literary tradition from the Han Dynasty onward, you know, in a lot of the rhapsodies on travel, so-called travel fu or xing fu. Xie Lingyun's fu talking about his travel and specifically of kind of his business travel, I suppose, from the capital Jiankang and all the way to to this general's where the general's army was in Xuzhou, I suppose. That's kind of, I think, Xie Lingyun is an interesting figure because in him, you know, he's a poet. He's also a very well versed in Buddhist doctrines, and and even helped with translation of one of the Buddhist scriptures. So in him, I we see both kind of modes of seeing. One is, you know, the what I call this traditional sort of a historical mode of seeing, you know, which can be seen very clearly in his fu about his travel, and along this route of his travel, he sees a lot of sites and cities. And when he sees those cities, he kind of think of this is a meditation on the antiquity, or thinking of what had happened at those sites. So it's basically when he saw those places, what he saw was actually kind of is very much kind of what he saw was texts, and a very specific kind of text, that is historical texts, and also the historical events that once had taken place in at those sites. And I think this is a kind of a mode of seeing, I think, was saw a lot actually also on the prose records of military campaign written at this period, because as I was saying, China was divided into north and south at the time. And so I think one particularly interesting phenomenon was for a lot of people in South China, under the rule of the, basically Han, Southern dynasties, the second and the third, the first of, after the Western Jin broke down in this, in early fourth century, a lot of the northerners just went to seek refuge in South China. And then their second, third generation descendants, so they would be born in South China, never having seen North China, never having seen, the great Han Dynasty capitals, Luoyang and Chang'an. And then actually in late 4th century, early 5th century, there were a number of military campaigns being undertaken by the Southerners, and they actually penetrated deep into the heartland of North China. And so these travelers, who basically were officers, and people who went with the, generals on these military campaigns, so they saw Luoyang and Chang'an for the first time in their life, But they had read so much about Luoyang the Chang'an before. And so, and not just Luoyang the Chang'an, but also the other side. So I think, you know, this is a kind of a mode of seeing the world as both familiar and strange. I mentioned in my preface to the book, you know, I said that, you know, the German writer and poet Goethe went to Rome for the first time, but he had read about Rome so many, you know, so often. And so the first time he was in Rome and he was saying, wow, everything looks to me familiar and yet everything is new. So I thought that must have been, you know, what a lot of people felt, you know, the Southerners felt when they first went to North China and saw those cities and sites. And so I think, you know, the what I call the historical mode of seeing was particularly kind of relevant in their writings about those cities and sites that they had read so much about in dynastic histories, you know, in records of various kinds. And now they saw for the first time with their own eyes what the place is actually like. And that, and also, you know, they tend to adopt this sort of mode of historical mode of seeing, that is, when they see a place, they don't just see the geography, you know, the landscape, they see history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and this is, you know, and it happened so that, you know, there is a kind of a long kind of native literary tradition on this kind of mode of seeing a place, and that is a huaigu, and a meditation on this, you know, size of history. And so naturally, they often adopt this kind of, you know, seeing and talking about a place in their writings. Yeah, so this is what, you know, one sort of way of seeing the world. But also, I think when I was talking about Buddhism's influence and all the, you know, importance of seeing in Buddhist doctrine, I guess what I should say, what I should also have mentioned, is that this stress on seeing and this emphasis on seeing with your mind's eye, I think in some ways translated into the secular discourse, into, this is very kind of a little bit of simplifying it, but basically roughly is this. That is, the subjectivity is really, really very important. You know, that is, the person's, you know, the seer's agency is very important in your encounter with the world. So what you see often, you know, kind of comes from the kind of person you are. And this is something that kind of is taught in the Buddhist doctrine. I don't know if this all kind of makes sense, but, you know, it's... Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but anyway, so I think, you know, this is, you know, so it's all this kind of emphasis on your agency, you know, on the kind of person you are, you know, and that is, you know, it's really in many ways determines what you see in a strange place. And I think this kind of abstract, you know, kind of concept and idea came to influence people a great deal, and, you know, consciously or unconsciously at this time. So I think another kind of, you know, and as I was saying, that, you know, all this becomes exemplified in Xie Lingyun very clearly, because he was a poet and he was, you know, also a very well versed in Buddhist scripture and a kind of believer, you know, sort of in Buddhism himself. And so this came to bear on his writing of, you know, landscape poetry. That is, you know, what he saw in this landscape, you know, whether you know, the kind of things you see there. So it's not just the physical mountains and water, but also he attempts to, you know, he's trying to see more than just that. I think in some ways you could say that this is a kind of a Buddhist influence that, you know, kind of coming to surface, because you see some, you know, kind of deeply, you know, sort of deeply embedded truths, or certain kind of, I would say, you know, kind of something, you know, more than just the physical, you know, kind of rocks and water and trees, but you also see, you know, patterning, you see kind of, you know, principle kind of manifested in nature. So I think, you know, that's one of the ways in which this kind of emphasis, you know, kind of on seeing with imagination, with mind's eye, you know, always kind of talked about in Buddhist scriptures. I think this is one of the ways in which it was manifested. That is, you bring kind of your own kind of vision to landscape. So there is a kind of, you see, as a result, you see much more than just a bunch of rocks and the trees. And just lakes and rivers, So you know that's a kind of you bring your vision to landscape and a kind of it illuminates the landscape. So it's a kind of a coming together of this person and landscape, you know, together, and all you know the landscape as a result is kind of illuminated because of what you are or who you are.
That's wonderful, and. Thank you so much. That's, I think, a really beautiful way of putting it. So, Xueling, you and I won't ask you too much about this because I want to also get to the wonderful 19th century material, which builds on this. But one of the things for listeners who haven't gotten a chance to read the book, you call Xie sort of a, or his poetry, a poetry of purgatory.
Yes.
In the next chapter. And that really kind of highlights one important thread throughout here, which is in addition to the historical mode of seeing, the importance of the kind of what you call the heaven and hell paradigm.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So, and not just in the wonderful travelogue that you describe of Fa Xian, but also later on in the next chapter, the ways that this theme of heaven and hell and this sort of rhetorical paradigm of heaven and hell also goes on to shape Xueling Yun's poetry. And then we also actually see that coming in obliquely or sometimes directly in the material in the 19th century.
Yes, yes.
That comes up later in the book. So let's for a moment move then to the part two of the book, which is encountering the world. And here you give us, I think, a really beautifully parallel, but not pedantically parallel, right? I mean, not parallel for the sake of formal parallelism, but really wonderfully evocative re-envisioning of these themes of seeing and dislocation and juxtaposition and travel as they emerge now in the context of a very different group of people. And this is, so in this section, which incorporates two chapters, a prologue and an afterword, you're looking at historical writing, ethnographic and geographic accounts, poetry, diaries, travelogues, to explore sort of several issues that come up in encounters with the foreign, but specifically the foreign as it is manifest in sort of Chinese encounters with Europe and the Americas.
Right.
So this set of chapters really looks very closely at how people were dealing with race, with gender, with ordering the world. So it's just a really wonderful, wonderful set of studies as well. Now, this focuses, especially the fourth chapter, focuses in particular on the first travelers who went overseas in the 1860s, right? And this is, you introduce us to Bin Chun in particular and Zhang Deyi.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit for us about who these two people were and why they're so important to the story?
Okay. Simply put, Bin Chun was actually a kind of a senior Manchu official being sent to, and Zhang Deyi was at the time was a young student actually of Tong Wenguan in the 19th century. And so the importance of these two people is that basically they were the very first people who were sent by the Manchu Qing court to Europe, and for the very explicitly for the specific reason of seeing things and looking and seeing things, looking at and take a look at those countries and come back and report what you saw. That's basically their mission, report all the customs, the state of things and what it is like. I think so they were really kind kind of the very first kind of official, you know, sort of, you know, mission sent to Europe through European countries at the time. And I think for me, though, their particular interest lies in that before them, I think I briefly mentioned that in the one of the prologue to this part two of the chapter, is that there are some accounts of, you know, Chinese authored accounts of Europe, but it's, I think one of them was really preserved in the court and as a manuscript, and nobody had much access to it. And also, I think they were kind of authored, something written by a sailor or kind of, and the interesting thing about, Bin Chun and the Zhang Deyi is that, you know, because Bin Chun authored kind of a bunch of poems, and also he kept a diary. So it's really the very, first kind of official sort of, not only was the first official kind of a people sent there to go through so many countries, but he came back with writings, and he was also one of the first, I would say, you know, kind of Chinese elite, members of Chinese elite who was, you know, officially sent. And so I think the importance of their writings is that, you know, simply put, there was just not very much, you know, textual, there's no not much textual kind of tradition for them, you know, to either, you know, to kind of to, they didn't even have many, you know, books to read or, you know, things to learn from, you know, about those European countries. So they were really kind of, in a way, rather, you know, they had rather fresh eyes, just put it that way. So that's, you know, because quickly people just caught on, you know, quickly, you know, there are more members of elite going to Europe, to Americas, and they came back, they all wrote a lot, and they published, they actually put them in print with very popular kind of printed editions of travel accounts going on. And very quickly, I think people began to have a lot of, you know, like a textual tradition already to, you know, to kind of to look at even before they physically visited those countries. For Bin Chun and Zhang Deyi, in early 1860s, they were really the very first people to see and write about the European countries, and, you know, and for Zhang Deyi, the Americas as well. So I think that's the freshness is what, you know, really kind of it made them very, you know, attractive to me, because I just want to see, you know, kind of how do you talk about a foreign country and see things, you know, how do you talk about something, you know, just bluntly put, something that you have never seen before, and that's completely beyond your horizon of expectation. How do you talk about them? How do you write about them? That's what really kind of, you know, where do you find the language to talk about that something that's so alien and foreign to you? And that's what kind of interested me. And, you know, and I always think of the most kind of one of the most funny kind of poems I encounter from this period, not by Bin Chun or Zhang Deyi, a little later. But, you know, but I think it's very exemplary, this guy talking about, you know, news, you know, in paintings and statues, you know, and he just, this is not just something, because I think it's easy to talk about the train. You can just say, this is, you know, kind of, you know, like this is a train as a machine, and, you know, it's like exotic, it's new, but it's very talkable in many ways. But the news, I think this implies a whole set of cultural, aesthetic traditions, and, you know, and so profoundly alien, and you basically have no vocabulary for it. And this is so, you know, I'm just so interested in the moment when people encounter things, not just like, you know, mechanical things and, you know, machines or, you know, high-rise buildings, but also when they encounter something profoundly alien in conceptual terms and cultural aesthetic terms, how do they actually, you know, manage to find the vocabulary to talk about it? And that in some ways, you know, is a connect, you know, and this is one of my arguments in the book, is that I think, you know, again, early medieval period and Buddhism provide a lot of the vocabulary that they could use, you know, to talk about something alien and strange. Even though this kind of, this model is quickly kind of, I think, being pushed or stretched to its utmost limit and almost, you know, kind of break breaking down, I think, as one can see very clearly in Huang Zunxian's poetry. That is, you know, they so in some ways they both use this, you know, traditional mode of seeing, you know, and this heaven hell kind of a paradigm of seeing. But also at the same time, 19th century was, you know, new, unprecedented, new for Chinese, new for Europeans and Americans too, because it's a post-industrial revolution world and people were living, you know, in this, you know, world where the traditional kind of order was quickly breaking down. It's a really new world dawning for people all across, you know, the globe. And so it was doubly kind of new and shocking to the Chinese, you know, because this is a foreign country, and also because what's going on, you know, worldwide, you know, Europe, America, you know, they see this post-industrial or industrial revolution going on. And so they try to still use, you know, they go back to something they know, which is this Buddhist kind of paradigm of seeing the world, you know, either in paradiso terms or in hellish terms. They employ a lot of vocabulary and images from, you know, early medieval period still, because this is something that they can still turn back to, they know how to do. And gradually, however, I think as their knowledge of Europe and America became deeper, and they realized that the existent paradigm of seeing things and talking about things no longer sufficed. And so, you know, you see cracks, you know, in their representation, tensions, you know, so this is roughly kind of, this is what really fascinates me, and kind of, this is roughly what I try to kind of talk about in part two of the book.
That's great. Now, you briefly mentioned this poet who wrote about painted nudes. This is Zhang Zui, is that
right? Yes, Zhang Zui, yes.
Who is just wonderful. And for listeners, you give us wonderful examples of his poems, not just on nudes, but also about women's mustaches and tap water and zoos and Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. I mean, this is just a fantastic archive. And it also allows us to get into the chapter five, the really substantive chapter that really closes the book before the afterword, which refocuses attention from just kind of, well, it's not like you've only, you know, you've just looked at prose throughout the book, right? The whole book talks about poetry. But this is a chapter that really focuses on the issue and the question of why poetry in these travel accounts, right? What work was being done in these poems and these poetic accounts that these travelers were composing, in addition to and juxtaposed with sort of prose notes and other kinds of genres. So, and this was a really, really fascinating part of the book. And Zhang Zui also is one of the people who is sort of emphasized, or one of the case studies that's very important in this chapter, along with Huang Zunxian, who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Now, can you talk a little bit about Zhang Zui's, in particular, his bamboo branch songs on London? And then this is the idea. So the questions for listeners like me, who may never have heard of a bamboo branch song, this was actually really fascinating, because one of the things you're doing here in asking, as you've just asked us, you know, where do you find the language to talk about the alien? One of the ways that these poets and scholars found the language is by using sort of rhetorical devices and forms from other contexts in which, and one of these was the bamboo branch song. So can you very briefly talk, what is a bamboo branch song? And can you say a little bit about this bamboo branch songs on London?
Sure. Yeah. Bamboo branch song is basically a kind of, one of those kind of poetic subgenres that, you know, by this point, by 19th century had a long kind of a history, and probably first, you know, was I think it first sort of appeared in the somewhere in the Tang Dynasty. I think maybe around 8th century or so. I'm not quite sure exactly, but I think that's probably what. But you know, to simply put, it is a kind of you know, short it's basically a short poem. It's usually it's a quatrain that is, you know, 4 lines, you know, and usually each line has 7 characters. So it's one of those 7-syllable line and 4-line kind of a quatrain poems. But it's a characteristic. It's basically that it's usually used to talk about the local customs of a particular place. And later on, and people actually also use it to talk about even just one site. For example, there are a lot of so-called bamboo branch songs about the West Lake, for example. But I think simply kind of summarize the, I think the importance of the bamboo branch songs is that it really uses a simple kind of, you know, language and a simple poetic form to talk about the characteristics of a locale, you know, the local customs, you know, and the local kind of quirks and eccentricities even of a particular place. And a kind of when you write a bamboo branch song about a place, it kind of, you know, the assumption is almost like, you know, you really know the place very, very well, and you can, you know, kind of describe, you know, the local, all the local, you know, interest, you know, local interest, interesting things about this particular locale. And you sometimes even pepper, you know, the poem maybe with some kind of a local, you know, dialectical terms, you know. And I think Zhang Zuyi used a lot of, you know, those very funny kind of transliteration of, you know, English terms. I just remember that 1 pound is 1 bang or something.
That's
like
right,
that.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but the thing is, I mean, he, you know, I don't think he really knows, you know, London. All, I mean, he knows London and doesn't really know London, but that's kind of, I think that's, it's not just a, you know, his a problem of just in Zhang Zuyi's case, but, you know, he obviously spent time there and he talked about the, what he considered kind of particularly strange or particularly kind of a noteworthy of the city of London. But I think, you know, his bamboo branch songs about London actually is a kind of, the reason why it's interesting is because it's, it contains, you know, this whole series of poems contains both poems and lengthy prose notes. So for tap water, he would write a quatrain, you know, a poem talking about tap water, and then he would also include a kind of prose note explaining what tap water is, you know, and how it works to his home audience. But I think he's a very, you know, funny character because he really exemplifies what I, you know, kind of refer to as the heaven-hell paradigm, the one extreme that is, you know, it's, I think I talked about his fear and loathing, you know, about London because he's really kind of, but it's funny because his prose notes actually are very full of, you know, rather you can detect a tone of admiration for the, you know, for the all sorts of new things, you know, inventions, mechanical inventions and all sorts of new phenomena, you know, he considers kind of marvelous. On the other hand, his poem kind of are always kind of, portraying these new things in quite, you know, explicitly hellish terms, especially one poem about a factory, and he really kind of describes it as if, you know, it were hell. And and so his series of, I think, is a very kind of a conflicted attitude. If you only look at the poems, you think that, oh my God, you know, he's entirely all about, you know, this whole world in London, this European world, Western world is very hateful and awful, you know. And but when you look at the prose notes, you know, it's almost like they're segregated, two segregated things. If you look at the prose notes, it's often the tone is neutral. And sometimes you can detect admiration for these, all these wonderful new inventions. reference, you know, like tap water. And so I think, you know, he's one poet who really kind of exemplifies this heaven-hell paradigm, because I think this, again, comes from Buddhism and, you know, back in early medieval times, you know, when people go, you know, kind of conceive of, you know, this cosmos, you know, the Buddhist cosmos as, you know, heaven and the hell, which were extremely, you know, all the vivid, you know, descriptions of heaven and hell in this time were extremely kind of, I think, fascinating for the contemporaries. And then they, when they go to a strange place, a foreign place, they tend to adopt this way of seeing, you know, that is seeing a place either as heaven or as hell, but it's often there's no in between. So, you know, that's how Fa Xian sort of conceived, you know, India, central India, as a paradise, because that's the birthplace of Buddha. But, you know, all around central India, he had to go through hell, literally oftentimes, you know, to get to that place. But he, you know, it's almost like a way of, it becomes a way of seeing and thinking of foreign alien world is either as terrible as hell or as wonderful as heaven, but either is exaggerated, and oftentimes there's no kind of a really encounter of the foreign as, you know, as another human world, you know, and at least, you know, you don't see this sort of kind of a description in those, you know, the early medieval travel account, you know, such as the one by Fa Xian. And I think in some ways, this kind of seeing the foreign world either as heaven or as hell, again, kind of, you can see that very clearly in the 19th century, all these encounters with European Americas, you know, it's either, you know, like a person like a Bin Chun would describe his experience as paradisial, you know, kind of wonderful, absolutely, you know, great, you know, he talks about the Buckingham Palace, you know, all in this, you know, great, you know, terms of, you know, like encountering immortals, you know, in a Western paradise, you know, very much still using the Buddhist paradise terms. And at the same time, you also see people like Zhang Zuyi, who's talking about all sorts of things, you know, he saw in London in hellish terms in his poems, even though Zhang Zuyi is a kind of fascinating because in his prose notes, he betrayed a kind of, you know, very uneasy admiration for those new inventions. But he seems to be not able to bring the two together or to see the Western world, you know, like as just as another human world, you know, just like human-like Chinese. No, I think this has to wait until Huang Zunxian, and only after he lived in the Western world for many years, and then he gradually, I think he is moving toward that kind of, you know, kind of a new, I think, conception of the foreign world, you know, not exaggerated like a paradise, you know, or like hell, but it's, you know, it's different and it's human. So I just find that kind of, it's just a, you know, just to say it, I find that really kind of fascinating, this way of, you know, thinking of and seeing the foreign cultures. Yeah.
And that's probably a perfect place to wrap up with the mention of Huang Zunxian for listeners. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Xiaofei, and I know we've taken up about an hour, so I'll wrap this up, or we can wrap this up now. But for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book, there are, in this final chapter, there are wonderful, very evocative, very moving discussions of not just these bamboo branch songs about London and poems and accounts by Wang Tao, but also especially three very wonderful poems by Huang Zunxian, one on arranging flowers, one on about called A Ballad of Taiwan, and then one on his little daughter, that each encapsulate in a really wonderful way precisely what you just said, this sort of change in describing the foreign that goes from explicitly heaven and hell to a more of an environment of conflict, sort of conflicting emotions, conflicting attitudes.
Yes.
And sort of conflicting sort of emotional experiences about the juxtaposition of the foreign and the familiar. So thank you so much, Xiaofei. I know there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, and I know we could talk for easily another 2 hours just on the poems and the translations. But is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about that you want to specifically flag for listeners who have or haven't had a chance to read the book?
I think, as you said, Huang Zhenxian seems like, indeed, it's, you see a kind of a gradual kind of a change moving from this heaven-hell paradigm to a much more kind of complicated and conflicted sort of, discourse, in Huang Zhenxian's poems. All I want to say, I guess, the only thing I would like to just add is that, I do argue that poetry, I think, is a particularly kind of, I think it's, I think late 19th century poetry is really, as I've been reading more of it lately, I just think it's a very fascinating kind of a world, actually, that probably, I just think it deserves a lot more study, because I think this is when poetry is something that really kind of people use, to try to make sense and to order this very, very different kind of new world that's happening around them. And I think, and oftentimes it comes across as a very kind of strangely moving and very effective, kind of a genre, actually, to deal with all the new things that are happening, and also to see the kind of cracks and to see the kind of gaps and the tensions, in this, the language and the kind of rhetorical kind of strategies, and how they use it to, basically to come to terms with what is, all the new things that are happening around them.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And is that, so what's next for you? Are you working on that right now, or is there another project right now that's particularly inspiring you?
I've been working on 19th century, a memoir, from the 19th century, late 19th century, kind of that's a project I've been working on. It's kind of translating, and also a kind of autobiography, actually, from late 19th century, which is, manuscript and never published, and in the modern kind of punctuated modern typeset edition, which I kind of discover and find really fascinating. And also I'm also working on 19th century poetry as well. That's a project I've been kind of doing, but mainly right now I've been primarily, I guess, my main energy is devoted to the also to the Three Kingdoms. I guess that's another kind of passion I have, and that is Three Kingdoms, again, from the historical period of Three Kingdoms all the way to the 21st century, actually. So that's wow. That's yeah.
Well, best of luck to you on that. It sounds like a wonderful set of projects. And this has been a really wonderful book. So thank you again for just an extraordinarily rich and evocative study, and for making the time today to talk with me about it.
Thank you very much, Carla, for all the wonderful questions and the really pleasant conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.